United Airlines agrees to pay a $2.25 million penalty for its role in a bribery scheme involving a one-time New Jersey State Attorney General who got the airline to provide direct service to his South Carolina vacation home. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. For more on the federal case and the public official, let's bring in WNYC's Matt Katz. Matt, welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. The official is one David Sampson.
That's correct. This is an individual who is about as close to Chris Christie as you can possibly get without being a member of the Christie family. They were friends for about 15 years. When Sampson was Attorney General, Christie was U.S. Attorney. They got death threats together from the Latin King street gang and forged a close friendship after that. Christie once described it to me as a father-son type relationship. Sampson had a lot of sway within the Christie administration, developing policy, picking appointees. He was Christie's campaign lawyer. He headed the transition team. I mean, these guys were tight.
Matt, that Sampson served as the chair of the powerful Port Authority of New York and New Jersey makes many question his role in Bridgegate.
For sure, as do emails that were passed between some underlings that indicated that Sampson was going to retaliate against the New York officials who reopened the bridge after the New Jersey officials had closed lanes there to punish a local mayor. But Sampson was never charged in Bridgegate. But that investigation and a ton of news stories about Bridgegate yielded all these other investigations and uncovered all this other information about what was happening at the Port Authority. And one of those things that was happening at the Port Authority, it turned out, was Sampson was allegedly trying to shake down United Airlines, the biggest airline in the world, to try to get this flight route created to go to his vacation home in South Carolina.
And I understand Sampson could be sentenced to up to 2 years in jail.
He could. He would have been sentenced to up to 10 years if he didn't plead guilty. Two things are notable here. One, he is not cooperating with the feds. In other words, if he has any information on anybody else, he is not turning it over as part of this plea deal. And that's intriguing, of course, because who knows what he might know about his close friend, Chris Christie. Also noted here that his lobbyist, who allegedly helped grease the wheels in this shakedown scheme where they got United to create this flight route in exchange for United getting lower fees at Newark Airport, which is run by the Port Authority. This lobbyist is someone by the name of Jamie Foxx, and he ended up being Christie's transportation commissioner after this scheme allegedly happened. So you have now, and he has been charged in, also today, so you have now two people today close to Christie who have been charged with federal crimes.
And Matt, what, if anything, do you make of the timing of today's announcement by U.S. Attorney Paul Fishman, the same day when Donald Trump has winnowed down his list of VP choices to three, one of whom is, of course, Chris Christie?
All I can say is it's bizarre, but I don't know if there was anything untoward here. This investigation has been going on for a couple of years. U.S. Attorney Paul Fishman said it was just ripe now, and now was the time to do it. He said there would have been even more questions if he released this information and did these indictments next week after the VP decision is happening. But it's been a bizarre day. I mean, here you have a constant cable news speculation about who the VP pick is going to be. Christie himself did a surprise live interview on MSNBC in the noon hour just as his best friend David Sampson was in federal court, and he was selling himself as the best pick for Trump. And then that sort of took away attention from what was happening in the courtroom with Sampson. I think, though, in the end, this will not really factor into Trump's decision-making process. I think Trump is going to end up going with his gut, and he's probably even already made the decision, and now we're just waiting to get the official announcement.
Matt, you seem to specialize in joining us on bizarre days. Thanks for being here on NewsWorks Tonight.
See you on the next bizarre day, Dave. Thanks.
WNYC's Matt Katz. The dust has settled on the 2016-17 Pennsylvania state budget, and as usual, debates over education funding and policy dominated much of the negotiations. Keystone Crossroads' Kevin McCrory gives us the lay of the land as lawmakers recess for the summer.
Last year this time, Pennsylvania Democrats and Republicans were still miles apart on budget talks, and it took until March to come to resolution. This year, a final deal was hashed out a mere 13 days overdue. So how, in a sharply divided government, do you get a deal done? Almost on time? Compromise and punt on the most controversial parts.
We made marginal gains this year, but it's progress nonetheless.
Vincent Hughes, a Philly Democrat, is minority chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee.
We don't seem to have the capacity to address major issues and come up with very significant solutions. We're inching along.
Governor Wolf had initially sought to boost the state's main pot of public school cash by $600 million this year, but he was willing to settle for $200 million to avoid another fight over proposals to hike sales and income taxes. Separate accounts for special ed, higher ed, and pre-K got boosts as well. Wolf's education secretary, Pedro Rivera, says that's good enough for now.
When you think of the fact that the General Assembly and the governor, you know, were able to find a way to increase education, you know, as significantly as it has, I think it's a good budget for us to have this year.
Among the ways the state is planning to pay those tabs is by hiking its cigarette tax $1 per pack and expanding gambling options. One bright spot in this year's education funding boost is that it will all go through the state's new student-weighted formula, so more money will go to the districts that need it most. There were a couple plans to help remedy districts, which were especially hurt over the past few decades by the lack of a formula. Sean Wiley, a Democratic state senator from Erie, says the new formula doesn't do enough right now.
What we need now is immediate funding to address the immediate concerns that we have.
But this and other proposals failed to garner serious consideration. Lawmakers, though, did secure an extra $10 million for distressed school districts. More than half will go to Erie. The rest will be split among Harrisburg, York, and Duquesne. A few other big issues got put off yet again. The state's nearly 20-year-old charter law, widely considered outdated, was left unchanged. Proposed reforms were put on the shelf to avoid breaking the fragile coalition of votes that got the larger deal across the finish line. PennCAN Executive Director John Sattell watched a handful of school reform priorities wilt this year.
But instead, what we got is significant but still insufficient increases in education spending, a patchwork of new but, I would say, unsustainable taxes, and no new accountability.
Maybe the biggest reason that Pennsylvania avoided another impasse is that leaders shied away from building unwieldy grand bargains. Instead, medical marijuana legislation was approved separately. So too was a bill expanding options for buying beer and wine. But another Republican priority, moving away from traditional guaranteed pension benefits for future teachers and state workers, was left on the sidelines. Even if many sides leave this legislative session somewhat disappointed, House Majority Leader Dave Reed says it should be apparent that leaders have at least learned how to keep the wheels moving.
It took us, you know, a year to really get a good hold on the perspective each other was coming from. And divided government takes folks willing to work together for the sake of getting things done.
Kevin McCrory, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY serves as the lead station. Turmoil followed the police shootings of Alton Sterling and Philando Castile and the ambush killing of five police officers in Dallas. Here to examine the responses on the campaign front are NewsWorks blogger Solomon Jones, joined by Jay McCalla, political blogger for Philadelphia Magazine.
With Trump positioning himself as the law and order candidate and Hillary trying to hold on to black support while wooing white moderates, what are the political implications of the moment, Jay?
Well, right now, the moment means something very, very different for both of these two candidates. Now, in the place of comprehensible policies, Trump has really good instincts, mm-hmm. and he knows that this moment is a frightening moment for an awful lot of people, and so he's doubling down on fear. He is now the law and order candidate, he's declared, and that's a smart way to go. He's appealing to the frightened. He's done that with Muslims. He's done that with immigrants. It works, whatever incomprehensibility about his campaign there may be. His instincts work.
The scary thing about it is that the language he's using is this, the same kind of coded language we've heard before. He said that inner cities are rife with crime.
Right,
you know, inner city is a code word, and it means black people.
Right.
What we've seen, though, in the wake of what's happening is that he's rising in the polls.
Yeah.
He's leading her in Pennsylvania.
He understands how to do this.
Yeah.
Look, George Wallace took a similar message and went from being the governor of a small state to being a regional candidate running for president with an impact on the outcome. Hate works. Mm-hmm. People do have fears. And when you're going to play to them, that's what he's doing. You got Hillary. This moment means something very different to her. She thought she had tucked away the black vote. Mm. Now she wants to pivot to a gracious convention and a gracious general election where she is the uniter, speaking to the broadest audience possible. She doesn't want to be talking about Black Lives Matter right now. And that inhibits her pivot to the general. So there's more peril in this moment for her than there is peril in this moment for Trump.
Let's move on to Bernie Sanders. This week, Bernie Sanders gives his long-awaited endorsement to Hillary Clinton. And with a new poll out from Politico showing Trump taking the lead in Pennsylvania and Florida, Clinton desperately needs Sanders' followers. But many of them still feel the burn. And contrary to popular belief, some of them are black. How does Clinton win over the black millennials and others, Jay? I'm talking to you.
Yeah.
Who are still saying
I'm a burner.
Bernie or bust.
I'm not a Bernie or bust guy anymore. In the end, we knew that Bernie was going to endorse the Democratic nominee. That was in the bag. Mm-hmm. Can she get the stragglers? I don't think so. There, you mentioned the African-American portion of Bernie's support, and I think they are the same people on the left who were very dissatisfied with Obama. Mm-hmm. Obama always had a little trouble on the far left. Hillary would have to do something big to say, okay, I'm not who you thought I was.
So let me ask you this question.
Yeah.
Bernie has gotten some stuff on the platform that would not have been there were it not for him. So Hillary's moving towards that $15 an hour. That's on the platform. What would she have to do to make those Bernie supporters who do not trust her move in her direction? Is there anything she can do?
She'd have to embrace some high profile thing of Bernie's, be it free college, be it universal health care. She'd have to do something big to say, I'm not who you thought I was. I sincerely am willing to share my agenda with you. I don't know that given her age and years of experience, she can get to some of these more left-wing positions. Mm-hmm. I don't know that she's just comfortable there. Mm-hmm. Her personal comfort level has a lot to do with it. And $12 minimum wage was an ideal compromise between 7 1/4 and 15. By comparison, 15 seemed radical. And I don't know that she's comfortable. She just doesn't seem comfortable being on the cutting edge of a social policy. Mm-hmm. Gay marriage, she took a long time to get around to, but then everybody did. But I just don't see her as being on the ramparts on social policy. So I think she's going to have to pivot, which was always her intention, and try to pick up white male votes in the general election. There's going to be a lot of people fleeing the Republican Party's big tent. She'll be trying to take some prisoners, seduce some prisoners, and catch them and bring them into the tent. And I think that's where her broader message, the general election message, will go. I think she realizes there are people on the far left who are beyond her reach.
Yeah. So we'll see. We'll see how that goes. And as we approach the DNC here in Philadelphia, I think it'll become even more apparent what her strategy is in that vein.
Solomon Jones writes the Philadelphia Experiment on Newsworks.org. He was joined by Jay McCalla, political blogger for Philadelphia Magazine. Still ahead this evening, a dance performance suspended over a river requires some flexibility.
When you're choreographing for concert dance in a studio, you are in control of the variables. Here, every day is different because nature behaves differently every day.
Dancing on the Schuylkill River as Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. Tomorrow night and Saturday evening, the Strawberry Mansion Bridge along Philadelphia's Kelly Drive will be decked out in silks and aerial equipment as it's transformed into a dance stage. The organization Invisible River is offering its annual celebration of the city's hidden river, the Schuylkill. WHYY's Kimberly Haas reports.
At this time of year, the Schuylkill River sparkles in the late afternoon sun. You might say the sun dances on it. For the past 4 years, choreographer Ali Vidic has been helping people dance a bit above the river's surface. In this year's work, called Beck Epic, three dancers will perform above and in the water while suspended from the Strawberry Mansion Bridge. Vidic says she likes the challenge.
There's so many possibilities in the water. There's so many things that you can do. The water is a viscous material that you can really push through, and it slows down the swing, it slows down the turn.
The end result looks graceful, with bodies gliding above the water. But co-choreographer Tatiana Hassan says the dancers must be ready to adapt.
When you're a choreographer for concert dance in a studio, you are in control of the variables. Here, every day is different because nature behaves differently every day. You have the wind, then you have the rain, then you have the tide. So the element of unpredictability is really high. You have to be more flexible and be more into structured improvisation. You have to move along with nature.
This year's performance adds more dancers than in previous years, and a set design of silks streaming down from the bridge.
This year we incorporated also more elements into the aerial dance. So we are including more visual elements. We have two big fabrics that are going to come down, and then there is also the boat to get the dancers into position and out. So that is also part of the choreography. So that's really a lot of build-up from last year's and from the previous years.
Beck Epic is a companion event to Saturday's Schuylkill River Arts Day, which will offer music, art activities, fishing, and circus demonstrations along Kelly Drive. For WHYY, I'm Kimberly Haas.
Bartram's Garden in southwest Philadelphia has recreated a flower garden from the early 19th century. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports that it's part of a plan to connect southwest Philadelphia to Center City.
Voices from the Chestnut Street Singers inaugurated the new Ann Bartram Carr Garden, a recreation of a one-acre flower garden established by Ann Bartram Carr in the 19th century. When Carr took over her grandfather John Bartram's botanical business in 1810, the grounds were commercial, growing and shipping 2,000 species of plants around the world. Under her leadership during the Industrial Revolution, the garden became public, says its current director, Maitre Roy.
People's lives were changing because there was so much industry all over. She, I think, made it important for people to take back plants to their home and enjoy green space at a time when people were starting to get surrounded by industry.
The original flower garden disappeared around 1893 when the grounds were given over to the city of Philadelphia. In the spirit of Ann Bartram Carr, the newly recreated garden will feature exotic ornamentals, including 36 types of roses. City Managing Director Michael DeBaradinas says the garden is a small part of a larger vision to draw neighborhood residents closer to the Schuylkill River and to Center City via the new Schuylkill River Trail, now under construction.
It's part of, I think, in big cities in America, the sort of the reconnection of the rivers that we've been so isolated from for the last 100 years. Bartram's is using its past as sort of the catapult into the future.
Bartram's Garden raised $2.7 million to create the garden and restore the original Bartram house. About half of that money came from the city. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional production today from Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.